You're listening to There's Power in Teaching, a podcast from PDK International. In this edition, our CEO, Dr. James Lane, interviews the 12th Secretary of Education, Miguel Cardona. Cardona served as the Commissioner of Education in the state of Connecticut before being appointed Secretary of Education by President Joseph Biden.
Secretary Cardona, welcome to There's Power in Teaching. It's truly a pleasure to have you here today. But before we dive into your time as Secretary of Education, I'd love to ask you about your own personal journey in education. And at our national conference in Educators Rising, and everyone that's ever been on the podcast, they know this, we ask the kids a question: what is the moment that you knew you wanted to be a teacher? We call it the Educators Rising moment. And we tell people to bring Kleenex, because a lot of our kids are first generation college kids. Tell them that story about why they wanted to become an educator. So I'm going to ask you, because I know our listeners would be curious to hear about your personal journey. What was the moment that you knew you wanted to become a teacher?
Well, thank you, Dr. Lane. First of all, so happy to be here with you. I'm so proud of the work you're doing and the work you've done in Virginia and at the Department of Education. And, you know, so to answer that question, man, look, I grew up in a community where big family, a lot of cousins, and we all went to the same technical high school. And, you know, my parents came from Puerto Rico when they were young so that we could have more opportunities. I was born in Connecticut. So for me, I went to a technical high school. I loved it. All my cousins were there. And I had always a desire to help people and just help the community. I was given so much by the local school system and by the local community. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't know I wanted to become a teacher. And I'm in my third year of high school, and I was using my artwork to talk about social issues, about, you know, I remember doing this painting in watercolor where it said, "We're all one race, the human race." And that was my way of dealing with what I felt back then was division based on race or people being segregated or prejudices. And, you know, I was using my artwork to communicate my feelings that we're all one, right? And I had an art teacher tap me on the shoulder and say, you know, here I'm learning how to fix cars for 3 years. This teacher taps me on the shoulder and says, you know, you should consider becoming a teacher. In that moment, man, like somebody saw something in me that I didn't see. And I started to think big. I'm like, well, maybe I can. Wow. Maybe I can go be the first one in my family to go to college and become a teacher and help my community that way. That lit a spark in me, James, that to this day is still there. And now I was blessed to be able to serve 21 students in my hometown, right? And now the scope of students is 65 million, but the passion to help my community started there. And that's when I knew that I could become a teacher and love what I do.
Oh, that's amazing. And I can't tell you, I do these interviews with well-known educators all the time. Certainly not anybody like the U.S. Secretary of Education, but I can't tell you how many times some of our top educators became educators because someone just tapped them on the shoulder and said, I think you would be great at this. I think you have a passion for this. And for a lot of people, I have found they don't really understand what the Department of Education does. And so in your own words, what's the mission of the department and how does it influence what's actually happening in our schools across the country?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And you know what? They're not alone. I was a teacher, I was a school principal, I was a district leader, I was a state leader. And for many of those years, I wasn't really clear on what the role was for the Department of Education. I knew what policies they initiated, and our job was to implement it. But I, you know, so that's important to share, because it was really important for me as Secretary of Education to make sure that the impact of the federal Department of Education was clear. For us, it's about, number one, protecting the rights of students. And as you can see across the country, a lot of students' rights are under attack. You know, students in general are under attack for being who they are. So for me, it's about protecting the rights of students. Keep in mind, you know, I came in as Secretary of Education when the pandemic had more than half of our schools closed. And it was really important in the beginning to make sure that students with disabilities had their rights protected, the right of getting an education with whatever special education accommodations were needed. So there's one piece there. It was about making sure that the Federal Department of Education promoted equity and access to all students, whether that's in K-12, making sure all children could read at grade level, making sure students had mental health supports, and then making sure students had access to higher education without a lifetime of debt. So for me, it was really important to stand on values and make sure that everything that we did at the department was protecting the rights of students and increasing access and affordability to education. And then at the end, you know, when public education was really under attack, it was about making sure we're unapologetically defending public education while people were trying to defund it.
Having my own experience where I worked in the Office of Elementary and Secondary Education, which, you know, goes right back to the roots of the U.S. Department of Education on the heels of the civil rights movement, protecting students is a big deal. And I know another big piece of the work that you all do is try to amplify the efforts of schools and school leaders and our students. And, you know, with everything that's happening across the country right now, there's a lot of challenges, but there's also a lot of positive things happening. And we hear about the challenges all the time. And so I want to start with like a really positive here. As you look across the educational landscape, what are some of the things that are going really well in the American education system, and how can we build on those strengths?
Absolutely. Look, I'm an optimist, man. I'm forever an optimist. I'm a father. And before secretary, I consider myself a dad, right? And for me, I look at the role and the experiences my children have had in public schools. And you know, I'm excited for them. I'm excited for the next generation. And yes, we could focus on the challenges. We could focus on the division. But you're right. There's so much going for our students and for our education system. First of all, across the country, there's more funding in education than there ever has been in the history of our country. We, through the Safer Communities Act, which you were instrumental in distributing the funding, I remember your passion was to make sure we get the money out quickly. We have funding for 16,000 more mental health professionals in our school. My sister's a school social worker. And I know how important her work is. We're in a youth mental health crisis, right? So having 16,000 more school counselors, school social workers is critically important. When I was a school principal, when I was a teacher, I always used to normalize that we have to do more with less. When we took over, President Biden was really adamant that we fund education differently. So, you know, funding for special education, funding for mental health supports is there. I'm really excited, James, about college and career pathways and how we're evolving our high schools to make sure students have dual enrollment programs so that they can start getting college credits earlier, making sure students have access to these careers that exist where you could be making $70,000, $80,000 a year without a four-year degree. Now you add on a credential, you add on a two-year degree, you could be making well over $100,000. And some of these things that are happening in our country now as a result of some of the work in this administration, like the CHIPS and Science Act. So I'm excited about the potential there for education to be poised as economic development for our country. I'm also excited about, you know, you got an additional $900 in Pell Grants, right? And we have a FAFSA process now that's a 15, 20-minute process where just last year, even with a first year rollout that was challenging at times, we had 500,000 more students eligible for aid, for federal aid. That means 500,000 more students could say yes to college. And that's something that's great for our country. So affordability and accessibility is there. I mean, not to mention the $170 billion in debt relief that we provided to public servants and people who were taken advantage of by our higher education system. I think there's more opportunity in the higher ed space. There's more opportunities for career pathways, and there's more opportunities for mental health support across the country for our students. So I'm excited about that.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I love that you said you're an optimist at heart. And actually, when I came to PDK and we adopted our new strategic plan, we adopted new core values. And one of those that we adopted is optimism, that we're always going to see the best possible outcomes for our students. And that's just amazing.
You know, James, let me just jump in with that, because another area that I'm really optimistic about is the space that you're in, that you're leading in. You know, when we came in, we addressed a teacher shortage, right? The teacher shortage is a symptom of a teacher respect issue in this country. And we weren't just talking about it, we were being about it. So what did we do? We established apprenticeships in teaching across the country, right? When we jumped into our jobs in 2021, zero states had paid teacher apprenticeships where student teachers were getting paid to learn and learn the craft of teaching. Today, we have 47 states that pay student teachers as they're becoming student teachers. So when you talk about progress and growth and changing the dynamics, we went from talking about teacher shortages to talking about paid internships to the best profession that there is. And I'm excited about that too. You were a big part of that.
Well, no, and thanks for saying that. As I think back on my 25 years in government service, you know, one of the reasons I left and went to nonprofit is I wanted to focus on teacher quality and the pipeline of teachers. And at Educators Rising, we've been lucky to just have amazing growth there. And I will say we actually applied for a Department of Labor grant and got it last year. And the work that happened over in labor to open up flexibility for apprenticeships, it's really changing the game for the future of our teachers. The next question I have is I want to look back on your 4 years as the secretary and talk a little bit about the things that you're most proud of. And so I can't imagine, you know, having been state superintendent in my career, district superintendent, I know the burden of leadership and I know the weight of that responsibility. So if we were to look back at the Biden administration from a historical perspective, and let's say there's a book written about your time as secretary, what do you think the title of that book would be? And what's the headline or what are some of the chapters that sum up your experience and what you've done and what you're most proud of?
So look, I'm most proud of the fact that we walked in when more than half the schools were closed across the country, where public confidence was gone, where there was so much division in education and public educators were under attack, where there was no guidance coming from the federal government on how to reopen schools and how to do it safely. Where there were emerging attacks on diversity. And we came in, we reopened schools within 9 months. We provided more funding to address disparities that we've normalized in this country. So what would the title of the book be? Is, you know, Thriving Despite All Odds, right? You know, some of the chapters might be Believing When No One Else Believed, Lifting Up the Best Profession. I would have to throw in there, as American as apple pie and rice and beans, because I'm unapologetic about my biculturalism and my bilingualism being a superpower for me. It's about evolving to meet the demands of our students. It's about disrupting broken systems and dusting off the status quo. You know, so when I think about higher education, people told me, you can't change higher education. It's so set in stone. That's baloney. You know what? We're going to change FAFSA, and it's not going to be easy because it hasn't been touched for 40 years, but we're going to change it, and we got it done. And now more students have access. More first-gen kids like me have access. They said higher education, the costs are going up. You can't increase accountability. That's BS. We did that, and we're going to continue to do that. So we have gainful employment rules that tell parents whether a school provides a good return on investment or not. So kids are not making decisions to pay $65,000 a year so they could graduate and get a job making $30,000 a year. That makes no sense. You know, we're evolving our high school. So I think the evolution has to be a chapter, right? Like, if we do what we've done, we're going to get what we've gotten. And we're not satisfied with achievement gaps being normalized in our country. We're not accepting the fact that a high school diploma, in many cases, doesn't mean access to middle class. So we're changing that, and we're unapologetic about it. You know, I have no qualms. I was a fourth grade teacher, and at the end of the day, I'm a teacher at heart. I'm not a politician. I'm not here to try to just live. You know, no, we're going to get this done because there's so many students that look like me. So many students 40 years ago, you know, my 8-year-old self would welcome a system that looks different than it looks now. And for too many kids across our country, the system hasn't changed enough to meet their needs. I'm excited about artificial intelligence and what it could mean to enhance learning. We have to protect our students and protect our systems, but if we're not evolving in education, then we're not serving the needs of our students in our country. So that book would have a lot of chapters, but it'd really be about thriving in the face of adversity, because public educators and public schools, we help our children see the potential that they have in themselves, even if they don't see it at first, just like me as a high school student.
It was amazing to me to hear you talk about how, you know, essentially half of schools in America were closed when you got on the job. I mean, it was only a matter of months before you were able to reopen all the schools. But I was thinking back to those early days, and I can't remember the speech, but I was still state superintendent of Virginia. And I remember the speech you gave where you talked about that you know, the things that you cared about were as American as rice and beans, like you mentioned. Talk to me about that moment, because I remember standing in a crowd and people were cheering when you said that. And it was like a new era was starting with this new leadership in education. That had to be such a big moment. Talk to me about what it means to you and your background and your communities as you became Secretary of Education.
Absolutely, James. You know, I always say that my grandparents, they left the paradise of Puerto Rico for the projects of Connecticut so that their children and their children's children could have a better life. So my grandparents and my parents, in essence, sacrificed opportunities and came here, didn't really know English, didn't know the culture, had to deal with cold winters in a housing, public housing. I was born in public housing because of this country, because of the public school system. I was able to advise the president of the United States. That's powerful. And in the process of becoming a teacher, a school principal, one of the things my family taught me, I always say I was born rich, but without material possessions. I had faith, I had culture, I had family. That's all I needed, right? So the Puerto Rican values of hard work, serving your community, giving back, having faith in other people and believing in partnerships, those are the values that helped me get to where I was, right? But I also had that pride in who I was, my language, my culture. And sometimes in our school systems, our students are made to feel like they have to abandon that or become like assimilate who they are to fit in. And I want to challenge that to say, no, I'm as American as apple pie and rice and beans. I love my rice and beans. I love my cultura. I love my salsa. And it's okay to be who you are and continue to grow and thrive. So for me, as Secretary of Education, as a Latino, as an educator, because you know not too many educators sat in that post. I said it's okay to be unapologetically yourself and celebrate who you are while lifting up the entire country. And for so many of our English learner students who, you know, intentionally or unintentionally, in mostly unintentionally in many cases, were made to feel like, you know, I have a deficit because I don't know English. I want to say, I'm going to flip that on its head. You're gifted and talented because you know another culture, you know another language. And when you have the Secretary of Education, I don't know Espanol or code switching and celebrating the culture, it's okay for them to say, you know what? No, I do have that. This other language is something that's a benefit. And I'm very cognizant, James, that I have the talking stick as Secretary of Education, and I'm able to project what I want my students to feel. They should be proud of who they are. And it doesn't have to be Latino. It could be students who come from a different country or rural students who have to embrace who they are, or students who are gay, or students who come from, you know, poverty, students who come from a totally different background. Be unapologetically you, celebrate who you are, and you can still grow and thrive, because that's what makes this country what it is, right? This is the only country where you see that. And I really embraced that, James. And I did it not only to tell the students that they are who they are and they should be proud of who they are, but also to honor my grandparents who sacrificed so damn much so that I could have the opportunities that I had. I wanted to tell them that I see you, that it was because of your upbringing, because of your sacrifices that I'm now able to advise the president.
Yeah, it's an unbelievable honor when you get that time in Washington. And I think my next question is, you know, thinking about the awe of those moments, how, you know, having gone through this transition myself from district to state to federal leadership, how does someone prepare to lead the entire nation's schools, and how did you really prepare to be the best secretary you could be?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And I think to the folks listening, whether it's secretary, school principal, teacher, superintendent, student. It's all the same. Half of it is you got to look inside of yourself. You got to look in the mirror and say, you know, am I pushing myself? Am my expectations on myself the highest they can be? Am I giving my best? Do I believe in myself? Am I working on those things that I value, right? So a lot of it is introspective. You know, there's always in every position, like, well, I don't have this or I don't do that. Like for me, I wasn't a DC guy. I was an outsider, you know, but the president, when he hired me for the position, he told me, he said, I want you because of your lived experience as an educator, as a person from Connecticut whose upbringing is the trajectory that you have. I need that. Instead of looking at, when I talk about being introspective, instead of looking at what you don't have, look at what you do have. So that's half the battle, right? How do you prepare? You look at the skill set that you bring to the table. And then one of the things that I've been so fortunate is to surround myself with really good people, you included. So the reason why the president looked at me as Secretary of Education was also because of the work that we did in Connecticut to reopen schools faster than many states using public-private partnerships, using the health system, the partnerships that we created there. You know, I coined the term intentional collaboration. So in order to reopen schools in Connecticut effectively, I had to be intentionally collaborative with people that I didn't typically work with. I used to joke around that I didn't know what an epidemiologist did 5 years ago. Yet during a pandemic, they were on my speed dial. I had to work with them to reopen schools. When I came as Secretary of Education, I had to learn how to work not only with the health system to reopen schools safely across the country, but work with chiefs, work with teacher unions, work with the medical community. I also had to learn, you know, when we reopen schools and when we're evolving, I had to work with higher education to make sure higher education is working with K-12. I had to work with the Department of Labor, Department of Commerce, to make sure that we're providing apprenticeship pathways and our teams are talking to one another. I had to work with hospitals and health associations to make sure mental health supports are being provided to students. So it's this intentional collaboration and this culture of we're stronger together that I think I had to nurture and make sure that I was acting upon. Because, you know, if you become isolated as a leader and you think you know all the answers, that's when you fail, right? So this culture of we're in this together and we're going to work together and I'm going to learn from you and you're going to learn from me and we're going to build consensus doesn't mean we compromise our values. It means we build consensus to work across party lines to benefit kids and never lose sight of the fact that we're serving children in this country. And I think if you can keep a focus on your why and also look at what you bring to the table, you can be successful in any position.
Well, in about 35 days, yeah. We are going to be installing a new administration in America. You know, we'll have new leadership at the U.S. Department of Education, right. At least at some point after confirmations and everything else. What advice would you give to the next team coming in sure. to make the biggest impact that they can make?
Yeah, you know, and it's an interesting thing, right? So when I became Secretary of Education, I was sworn in on March 2nd. And, you know, I started working March 3rd and just like traveling and visiting schools and all that. But it is interesting. In this country, it's so fascinating that, you know, at 11:59 on the day of inauguration, you have one administration. And at 12 o'clock, you have another administration. And that's just how it works, right? And it's so unique. And it's something that we have to preserve in this country. So when the new administration comes in and the period of confirmation and the secretary comes in, there might be some months. But, you know, my advice is just kind of what I did, right? Listen, you know, get a feel of what the needs are, what the people are saying. Ensure that the policies that you create are connected to the processes that roll those policies out, right? That a good idea written on paper is only as good as, it's only worth as much as that paper unless you're thinking about how to implement it in a way that respects the different perspectives on the ground, whether that's our parents, our students, our educators, our leaders, and that, you know, we're stronger together. That when you have, just like reopening schools, at the state and at the federal level, when you have more people's fingerprints on the plans, that are rolling out, there's a greater likelihood that those plans will outlive the person that's pushing the plan. So be intentional about listening to the perspectives, even the perspectives that disagree with you, so that whatever you're pushing out there, it's what the people need. And then also just make sure that you're keeping an eye on defending public education. Public education is the greatest good. Public education is why a kid from a very impoverished neighborhood that learned English as a second language could develop the skill set, could get the educational acumen to then advise the president of the United States. You know, that this is what makes this country a destination country for so many people all over the world. They want to come here because we have systems that people didn't think could work. Public education is one of those. And just preserve and strengthen public education in the process, and listen to those folks who are on the ground, who are doing the work, who understand our children and really want to see our children succeed. Make sure that they're part of the conversation.
What are some of the things that you wish you had done, or what are some of the things that as they start to take over, like, gosh, I hope they go after this.
That's a great question. We saw subgroups of students that have historically underperformed outperform different subgroups. Like, for example, from 2022 to 2023, Black students in reading grew more than non-Black students in reading. And it's been the greatest growth since 2009. I'm proud of that. That tells me that if you focus on addressing achievement disparities and you put resources there, students will deliver. So I hope that closing the achievement gap is something that continues. We've done a lot of work redesigning high schools and two-year college programs to make sure that they're responsive to the industry needs, to the labor needs. So we're having pathways into careers that don't require a four-year degree. Oh man, tons of funding and energy has been placed there. That's going to continue to grow. And I hope that that's something that can continue in red states and blue states. I hope that there a connection between K-12 and higher education can continue. I also hope in higher education that we continue to make it more affordable and more accessible, that we continue public service loan forgiveness. You know, before I became Secretary of Education, in 4 years, only 7,000 people benefited from public service loan forgiveness. Those are our nurses, our teachers, our police officers, our firefighters, our veterans, who are public servants, who have tons of student debt. Well, after 10 years, they should have their debt forgiven. That was a law that was passed in 2007, but only 7,000 people got it before I became secretary. We got over 1 million people in 4 years. I hope that that can continue so that higher education can be more accessible and more affordable. Those are some of the specific things that I hope can continue to happen. The mental health support, the teaching profession. I mean, you could talk all you want about good program, good curriculum, good whatever. If you don't have high quality teachers in front of the students, then it doesn't matter. So the investments that we made into the profession, lifting up respect in the profession. You've heard me say it a million times, James. The ABCs of teaching, right? Providing agency to teachers, better working conditions, and competitive salary. That matters. And then if you add a D, diversity in the profession, so that our profession can be as beautifully diverse as our country. Those are things that cannot slow down. We've made some gains, but we still have room to grow in this country, and I hope they can continue that work.
Yeah, well, you know that the work that we do is focused on the teacher shortage and trying to make a difference. And our program is about working with high school kids to help them become the best educators they can be later in their careers. You have done an amazing amount of work to lift up the teaching profession. What do you think needs to be done over the next 4 to 8 to 12 years to solve the teacher shortage and to make sure that every kid in America is taught by a high quality teacher?
It's sad that we normalize in this country that teachers get paid 24-25% less than people with similar degrees in other professions. Why should we be like shocked if someone suggests teachers should be making over $100,000? That in any other profession, that's normalized. Why do we make it seem like we can't do that? And that most teachers have a master's degree, you know, and their years of experience in the product, they're creating tomorrow's leaders. You know, Linda Ransom, that teacher that tapped me on the shoulder, okay, in high school, who I still keep in touch with, she was able to change my trajectory in life. And not only about the job, but my children's lives are better now because of the tap on the shoulder. You see what I'm saying? So, you know, I do think we need more programs like the ones that you're leading, but it has to be normalized. It can't be just pockets of excellence across our country. This has to be existing in every district across our country if we're serious about addressing the teacher shortage. And it goes beyond addressing the teacher shortage, because you could put somebody in front of a classroom, but they may not be qualified. They may not have the disposition to become teachers. We need teachers that are going to change the world because they're passionate in education. And we shouldn't normalize that they have to get another job, or we shouldn't have to tell teachers that they have to compromise their goals in life because they're not going to have a salary that could help them buy a home or pay off their student debt. See what I'm saying? So let's lift the profession, agency, better working conditions, competitive salaries, making sure that there's pathways to the profession that are normalized in this country. And we need groups like yours and the federal government working together to make sure that every kid across the country sees the value in teaching and looks at it as a viable pathway to a career.
Thank you for leading during this time. I mean, you took over in the middle of a pandemic, yeah, and you made an amazing difference in our American schools with the focus, the fortitude, and the seriousness with which you took that challenge to get all of our kids back in school. And I know, like I said before, I know the burden of leadership, and I know how difficult this job can be, but you led our nation's schools in a way that we can all be proud of. And I just want to say your leadership, your vision, your commitment to improving education have made a tremendous impact, and we appreciate everything you've done. So thank you for joining us today. That is There's Power in Teaching, our podcast from PDK International. And we just want to thank you again, Secretary Cardona, for joining us today.
Thanks so much for the opportunity. And, you know, we serve children in this country. There's nothing better than that. So to all the educators, future educators and leaders out there, just keep shining. Public education is the greatest investment we can make in this country. Thank you.
There's Power in Teaching is a production of PDK International, headquartered in Arlington, Virginia. For the full interview with Secretary Cardona, visit kappanonline.org. Kappan Magazine is the membership magazine for PDK members.